You know, the liberty that was in that, of loving God with all my heart, and seeing that it included my enemies, and it didn't matter at all their character, that they could not keep me from loving them, and the liberty was they could not control me. Their actions were not determinative, could not determine my actions towards them, my love for them. They could not nail me down and put me in a box and keep me from loving them. And that's the liberty of the soul when it enters into loving God supremely and loving your neighbor as yourself. It can do everything the law requires because it's not conditioned upon the character of another person, their actions towards you, whether they like you or don't like you. It is not dependent upon anything external. It is only dependent on whether you're willing to do so. And people could no longer control me. Their comments, their looks at me, looks of disapproval, you know. I didn't retaliate from him, I didn't pull back from him, I didn't alter, I wasn't intimidated. All that disappeared because those are things that I considered so important to me. Why? Because I was using everybody else to gratify me and seek my good, and it depended on whether they would have the attitude towards me as if I would get something out of them. So I was very much controlled by other people's treatment of me because what I would get out of them was threatened. If I couldn't manipulate them, all the manipulating had to go away, and it did. All the trying to control other people went away, because the only reason you control other people is to get your own way. When you're no longer seeking your own, but they're good, you don't try to control them, and they can't control you. And the heart is free. Free to pursue that which it is committed to. It doesn't matter what other people are doing or not doing. You stop manipulating people. You stop controlling people. Your interest is in what you can do for them, not what they can do for you. It's marvelous. I was free. Free indeed. So, this love has all these other implications and all these ramifications and all these consequences to it when you actually have entered into it. Heart is free of manipulating others. You're not concerned about what they can give you. They don't need to give you a thing because you don't even notice whether they're giving you anything. That's not your concern. Your concern is if you're giving, if you're doing them good. You're not even concerned of whether you're keeping the law. Your mind is concerned whether you're doing somebody good, not whether you're keeping the law, which is and does keep the law, but that's not your concern. Your mind isn't involved. Am I keeping the law now? Your only concern when you become devoted in love for God is whether you're promoting His interest and doing Him good as He should be, and whether you're doing your neighbor good. That's how you measure your life. That's how you measure your success. That's because that's what your end is. Now I need to turn to 1 John 4:10. You're going to have to forgive me because 1 John 4:10 always cranks me up. It always generates something within me. John 4:10 tells us what love is in a very practical way, in a different way. What is love? 1 John 4:10. Wonderful verse. Wonderful verse. Where does the Bible say what love is? 1 John 4:10. Because 1 John 4:10 says, herein is love. Here is love. This is love. We would expect 1 John 4:10 to conclude by telling us what He promises to tell us. What love is. Right? So herein is love. Not. First thing He says is not. He's going to tell us what love is not, in order so He could tell us what love is. 1 John 4:10. Love is not. What? What is it not? Not that we loved God. Now how does that tell us what love is? Well, it really does help us. Love is not that we loved God. You ever go out to the sunset? Standing in the sunset around other people maybe? Something. Man, that's beautiful. Oh, man, that's beautiful. You see pictures, you know, travel pictures or something, or beautiful pictures of the Alps. Just some of the beautiful things that God has made in this world. And thank God He made us to really enjoy them. Wouldn't it be terrible if he made such beautiful things and we had no sense of beauty? But he made us capable of seeing the beauty. He made us compatible with his physical creation so we could see the beauty of his creation. How beautiful God must be, sense of beauty he must have to create such beautiful things. But you stand out there and you're looking, oh man, that's beautiful. You know what you're doing? You're appreciating something that is in and of itself beautiful, marvelous. You're appreciating it. There's no virtue in that. There's no will involved in appreciation of the Alps or the sunset. You don't decide, I'm going to think that's beautiful today. And then therefore you say, oh, that's beautiful. It is an involuntary response of the mind to something that is beautiful. No will in it at all. There's nothing virtuous in saying, gee, that's beautiful. Now, herein is love. Not that we, who have the ability to think about God, and when we think about God, we appreciate what we think about. That when we think about God and his power, our minds go, man, this creation, it's power that must be behind it. When we think of his wisdom, his intellect, look at the design in the creation. Look how our minds work. And our minds get awed with some of the character and nature of God as we think about it. But God just made us that way, and there's no virtue in having those kinds of thoughts, even great awe about God's being. But people think that is love. People think that we, the creature, the sinner creature, who have a great appreciation in our minds for this great, excellent, holy being and righteous being that we hear about, and the more we hear about it, the greater the concept is, that we think we love God because our minds approve of his character. Our minds approve of God, therefore we think we love him, because we approve of him the way he is in his being. We think that's love. And we carry that all around in our relationships. You know, you ever heard the song? Some of you old enough to know the song? You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. You ever heard that song? You've lost that loving feeling. Okay? Other songs to the effect that what is in you caused me to love you. Your characteristics make me love you. Force me to love you. I can't help it. And that's the world's view of sin. And that's what people think when they think that they love God, because when they contemplate his character, oh, that's marvelous. I must love him because I think so highly of his character. And the same thing in human relationships. Man, you just make me love you. You know what else is the flip side of that? If you change, there's no reason for me to love you anymore. You know the pressure that puts upon a person to never change and remain the same and always be watching to see if you think they are changing, and fear that if they think you are changing, that you won't love them anymore? You know the kind of pressure you put upon a person when you tell them, I love you because, and you name something about them as why you love them? Because when you say and say, I love you because, the reason you say I love you is now something that they want to make sure they hold on to so that you'll continue to love them. Tyranny. It's not love. Herein is love. Not that the sinful creature, even just the creature without sin, appreciates the character of God. It's not love when you look at something that is lovable and lovely and give it its proper regard. That's not what love is that John is talking about and the law is talking about. Herein is love. Not that that which is lovely is appreciated for its loveliness. But that which is lovely denied himself to the point of giving up his most valued relationship in his son for the sake of those who hate him. There is nothing in you or I that is the reason God loves us. God does not give you a because. He does not say, I love you because you are this or that or the other. You or I cannot control God's character and make Him love us or stop loving us. That's marvelous. He is beyond our ability to control Him. We can't turn off His being love, and we can't make Him love us. We can give Him no cause to love us. Because if we could, then we can turn it off and He would stop loving us. We would cause God to change. The marvelous thing is that God is a being who is in and of Himself committed to the greatest, highest good of the universe and is love. Fourth, the eighth verse. The one who does not love God does not know God because God is love. He is in a state committed to promoting the highest good of another for its own sake. That's love. See it there? You can't turn Him off, and you can't turn Him on. He is love. And it does not have to do with you. It has to do with Him. And on the other hand, when a person gets committed and devoted and becomes benevolent and loves God with all their heart, that's why nobody can turn you off from loving them. And they can't cause you to love them. You would love them, and you do love them because you're committed to love them, because you are love. In the degree in which you are a being, but not in God's infinite degree, but the same in kind. When you become benevolent, you work for the same ends that God is working for, and you have the same character that God has, you have the same motives that God has, and nobody can turn you off from loving them, and nobody can turn you on and make you love them, vice versa. That's what love really is. It is independent of the character of the other person. So that when you get to Romans chapter 1 and the works of the flesh in Galatians and other places that describe in detail the heart of the wicked, God doesn't send people to hell because the wicked are so wicked He stops loving them. He sends the wicked to help to uphold law in His government for the greatest good. Because law requires the execution of punishment or it's not law. It's not because he doesn't love the sinner. But what he is committed to is the greatest good in his universe, and the sinner must be punished because law must be upheld. So it isn't as though God has turned off his love for sinners, and then through the atonement of Jesus Christ, the love of God gets turned on for sinners. He is eternally benevolent. He changes not. He has always been benevolent. Marvelous. Good news. I told you I'd get cranked up. Same truth you'll see in Romans chapter 5, verse 8. Herein is love. No, that's where we were just at. Romans 5, verse 8. Probably all know it. Same pattern. But God demonstrates His own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we still had a character that could not be appreciated as a lovely character because it's not a lovely character. Yet He is still devoted to our good because He is love. And the evidence of the degree of His love is He gave up His only Son in order to promote that good. John 3:16 lays out the same pattern. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. Not so loved the world as so much love, as such a kind of love. It wasn't that God finally got up enough love that was great enough to give up His only begotten Son. But He has always had the kind of love that this is a demonstration of. Marvelous. The God that can be trusted has never changed. But people who have represented Him have represented Him incorrectly as a God who doesn't love the sinner until Christ died, and now He's willing to love the sinner. Always loved the sinner. He's always loved all moral beings. He is love. Sinners can't turn Him off and on. I needed to include that in our discussion of love. Another way of saying the commitment to promote the good of another for its own sake is the end in view, and all I do is good for you and no other reason. the end in view in all I do is good for you and for no other reason. Good is the aim in benevolence, the promotion of good. In talking about this, I have to talk about briefly about ultimate intent, because that's what the law is addressing, and that's what love is about. Ultimate intent. The end in view. The end in view. When I began to be convicted, I began to be convicted only when I realized that sin consists in having an end that's forbidden by the law and not the actions I took to achieve the wrong end. My actions are all means. Your actions are all means to an end that you live for. And they take on the character of the end that you live for. So when your actions are sinful, it's because they are means that you are carrying out to accomplish your end. And that's why they take on their character. But it's the end that a person lives for, that the law addresses. And if you have an end that is forbidden by the law, then that person is in a state of sin because their end is a forbidden or unlawful end. In benevolence, the end is the promotion of good for its own sake, according to our natures and relations, opportunities, all these other conditions that come into play. But the end is the promotion of good. The opposite of that is the promotion of self-good supremely. The sinner is conscious that he is seeking to promote good. You'll never convince the sinner that he is seeking to promote evil. He is not choosing sin. He is not seeking to be evil or wicked or be sinful. He knows he is seeking good. But his sin consists in seeking his good supremely. And keeping the good that he could promote to his neighbor away from his neighbor and away from God. What the sinner needs to see, and the law points out, is he is seeking good, but partially, only for himself. It is himself that is always in view when he is willing to do good, expecting something in return, is what I'm talking about. As Jesus said in Luke chapter 6. So the end is what is addressed by the law. Everybody lives for one end only. I'll just say this in passing. There is really only two choices in life. What end you'll live for. You either live for the end that the law requires, or you're living for an end that the law prohibits, and that is self-good. Once you make that choice, your whole being goes into action, and you start choosing means to carry out that end. Your whole life is filled with actions, volitions, as somebody pointed out here. Volitions are the execution of the means that one has chosen to carry out their end. But God began to convict me. I saw that sin had to stop, that I had to love God with all my heart, therefore sin would stop. But I didn't understand, really, until I began to see the character of all my actions. All my actions had one thing in common: the ulterior motive to get something from me. I only had one problem: my motive. I only had one problem, not my action, my motive for doing them. One problem. And the law commands us that we have a particular motive, and sin and disobedience is choosing a motive that is not acceptable to the law. What's God's ultimate end? The promotion of good for its own sake. Think with me briefly on this. This is really important, but we won't spend a lot of time on it. Isn't the well-being of another person a sufficient reason to will it? Have to be any other considerations before it would seem a good thing to will the good of another person? Isn't the happiness of a person, the well-being of a person, sufficiently strong in the mind as a reason to will it? Let me ask it a different way. If I meet you, I have only two choices. Either to treat you impartially and will and promote your well-being for its own sake, or continue to promote my well-being for its own sake. I only have two choices. Which is better? Wouldn't your mind and everybody's mind agree it would be better to be benevolent to my friend, be impartial, than to be selfish? Every mind affirms that truth. That's as simple as that. That that the well-being of another is a sufficient reason to will it. The good of another. The value of good is the grounds for willing it. You don't will the value of a good to another, their well-being, to get anything out of it or to accomplish some other end. You don't will the good of another person's well-being for its for it. You don't will the well-being of another person so you'll get saved. That's an ulterior motive. You will it for its own sake. And that's a sufficient reason to will it, because it is a good in and of itself. But I discovered all my ulterior motives. Man, I am surprised. They all have this common thread. They all my actions have one end, to get something for Dennis. Not material things, just everything. The end in view in all I do is good for you and no other reason. That's the end to be committed to. Now, this aspect of nature and relationships we're going to get to here under moral government, which is what we're moving into. Moral government itself, not the moral law. We're going to shift gears here. Though with the foundation of moral law, it will apply in moral government. And as we continue through the afternoon, when we get to the third session, God's character, you're going to see, I hope, through the development of these understandings of moral law and what its requirements are and what it is, you're going to see God's character differently than before, more enlarged than before, I trust, and you're going to see the reasons to trust Him. You're going to see, and I trust it's even developing now in your thinking, that God's character is of such a kind that He can be trusted absolutely to provide all the good that you need so that you don't need to secure your own good. You can leave it in His hands, confident He'll give you the good that you need because that's what He's devoted to. But according to His wisdom and not yours, according to His understanding and not your desires, and that produces such a submission to His will, it radically changes the heart. We'll throw in the atonement as well. Moral government is the government of moral beings. The government of moral beings. Moral government is the government of moral beings through the administration of law. Moral government is the government of moral beings through the administration of moral law. Moral government is what human governments exercise. You might say, well, they don't have moral laws. Their laws aren't very moral. Well, there's a lot of deficiency in human government, because human governments can only go so far. They can't come into you to your house and arrest you for presently at that moment hating another person. They might, if that hatred was in a crime now, they might include that in the considerations of the crime as the motive, and include hatred as part of the motive as an increased reason for penalty. But people can't come in here and arrest you just because you might be presently selfish or hate somebody. You've got to act on it before that you're subject to human government. Whereas God's government addresses purely the motive, and God knows the thoughts and intents of the heart. So, even if sin isn't confessed, God knows it. And He is administering His kingdom. Now, to keep from people hopefully questioning whether He has a moral government, just contemplate various scriptures and descriptions that demonstrate that He does. That Jesus, upon His shoulders, would be the government. The peace of His government shall be no end. Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Nebuchadnezzar was taken off His throne for 7 years. Do you remember the story? Why? So he would, after 7 years, and God gave him his sanity back, would acknowledge it is God that puts people on thrones, and it is God that takes them off. God is involved in human events and human government because He is the overall governor of moral government, and human government's a part of moral government. And the family is the smallest entity of moral government. Wonderful. The principles work all the way down. It's wonderful. I teach some child training classes, and we apply these principles to the family structure. Who's responsible for what? When you're responsible, nobody else is. If you're You're responsible. It's your duty to carry it out, etc., etc. And it throws away a lot of bickering in the home over who should have done this and that and other things. It's a marvelous application. So moral government is the government of moral beings through the administration of law. Now we have an understanding of law, do we not? What it commands, there must be penalties, there must be punishment. In government, there must be these rewards and punishments. Is government different than physical government? Physical government is a government by force. Under all the physical laws that we talked about, it is a government by force. So all physical objects are governed by force. God makes sure that they all act according to the rule of action that He has determined for them. But under moral government, moral agents are not ruled by force and forced to do what the law commands, but they are administered and they are commanded to do it, and then they are given rewards for obedience and punishment for disobedience. And the concern is not just for the individual, but now in governmental considerations, it is public good that is being administered. It is public justice that is the concern of government. And this is one of the significances of moral government understanding, that God, when He punishes a sinner, is not pouring out His vindication against the sinner as a personal affront between just the sinner and him, but God is upholding law and all the benefits that come from government and law. And when the sinner destroys the good through his selfishness, He is administering punishments to uphold public justice, not to pour out His vial of wrath for personal reasons. You would never, never find it acceptable in a decent society for somebody in government to pour out His personal vengeance upon an individual through the use of His public power. That's not acceptable. To go after an individual that He personally disliked and then bring all the powers of government to use them against a personal enemy. It would be not a good governor. But God is upholding public justice, the public good, so that punishments are an administration and upholding of law for the public good. That is the ground or reason or justification for moral government. Moral government is a necessary means to promoting the greatest public good. Without moral government, the greatest good could not be promoted. The necessity as a means to promoting the greatest good is its justification that there be moral government. In family life, there might be some kind of good going on, but a greater good is accomplished when moral government is implemented. There might be good things happening between you and I in America if there was no human government, but a much greater good is accomplished when there is government and law and it is rightfully carried out. Everyone has a sense of security in their homes. That's why, you know, the crime bill and all, when people lose a sense of security in their home, they want more law, more government, because government is known to be a necessary means by which the well-being of all of us is increased as a whole. Now, maybe some individuals would not find their well-being increased because they oppose the rule of law, or they have selfish interest that particular law is cutting across. When they drove out the people in Rwanda, that poor country, I don't mean economically, but miserable, miserable what's happening down there. Of necessity, those people will cry out for a government, because everyone knows we need government, human government. So you throw out one and you must have another one come in, or there's this vacuum. Somalia? Perfect example of what happens when there's no government. Total anarchy. Is that good for the people? No. Is a good, stable government of law, not will, but law, much better than anarchy? Yes. And that is the reason why it's justifiable. So that is the justification for it. Now, some of the conditions of moral government are our natures and relationships. Here's what I mean by that. As moral agents, having the nature of moral agents, the intellect, the will, the sensibilities, having light, knowledge, having that nature and relations is a necessary condition before there can be any government. Let me explain. You might have the nature of a moral agent. You might have will, intellect, sensibilities. But there's nobody else around. If there's no other being in the world, if there's no other moral being that you know of in the universe, there's no need for government, because you don't have any relations with anybody. But as soon as you know that there's another moral being that exists, you are under the necessity to decide how you're going to relate to that person. As soon as that relation is created, where that person exists, and you both have the same natures as moral agents, there is a necessity for government. There's a necessity for a law by which both would be required to live under and to adhere to, so that it creates what kind of relationship they'll have. And both would agree, if there were just two people, it would be better to treat one another kindly than harshly. Both would agree that it would be better if both were not selfish than if they were selfish. So you don't have to have great big thick books out of political science for people to understand intuitively what good government and good law would consist of. And that's why people overthrow dictators and things, because that's why you can get a whole majority to agree, this guy's got to go. Confidence in government is what gives government its power, moral government. Confidence in moral government gives moral government its power, and that is the only source of its power. When moral government changes to physical government and forces its subjects to obey, it is no longer moral government. It's physical government. And has no justification to exist. Let me make a distinction between government and politics. Some people confuse them. Government is necessary. It's appointed by God. Is a wonderful good thing and necessary for the promotion of good. Politics is the effort of people to gain access to the power of government. Okay? But government and politics are not the same thing. And oftentimes people are down on politicians, so they think government should be destroyed, but eventually that gets worked out because they know that government is necessary. But politicians and government sometimes get confused in people's minds. When you have a room or a country filled with moral agents, everyone's level of understanding will be different. Everyone's level of knowledge will be different. At least there might be some who would have equivalent knowledge, but there's going to be these variations because of age, experience, teaching, and the rest. So that in a society it would never be possible to get unanimous agreement on how things ought to be run. Because of different levels of understanding. Therefore, without the rule of law and a government to administer it, you would get people bickering over how things ought to be done, how they ought to be carried out. I think you should do this. No, I think you should do that. And you would have chaos because of ignorance. Moral government is necessary not due to the sin of people and their wickedness, but their ignorance. Because of the different levels of knowledge, so you have people fighting over sincerely held views, but their level of knowledge, so that a wiser person would know that this wouldn't work, would not be good for all. This person believes it would be the best, but very much inexperienced, immature. So it would be necessary to appoint somebody through representation or whatever, some form, that person is to make decisions, and we'll all live by them. That's government. That person is responsible to make the decisions on these issues that have been designated, and we're responsible to follow. When you have a governor and the governed, the governor has the responsibility to govern according to law, and to seek the good of those that are governed. The governed have the responsibility to follow the law and the direction of the governor. There's a mutual responsibility. One of the responsibilities in this relationship is that both the governed and the governor have the obligation to make any personal sacrifice needed in order to promote the public good. The relationship between governed and governor creates the obligation for the governor and the governed, depending on the circumstance or the need, Both must be willing to make any personal sacrifice of self-denial necessary when called upon to, when it's necessary, to promote the public good. That is the reason why God gave His only begotten Son. Because it became necessary upon the governor to make a sacrifice for the public good that no one else could make. And if he was going to complete his eternal purposes, it was upon him to make the sacrifice because he could make it. No other being except himself would qualify to provide that atonement that could secure what his eternal purposes were except himself. And he was willing to do that. And that was an obligation upon him to do that, if it was possible to do that. And he demonstrates his love by fulfilling his obligation and sending the Son. The entry of the world into the world by Jesus Christ, his life and then his suffering and death, is the highest demonstration of the character of God. We'll get into that the third hour. Nothing else is as high a demonstration of the character and love of God as the coming of Jesus Christ. It is the proof. And if the coming of Jesus Christ and his suffering and death will not persuade you to trust God, nothing else can. If that will not break the sinner's heart, bring him down to trust and submission, nothing can. Because that is the highest demonstration of the love of God for sinners and the character of God in and of itself. We all recognize that it is more important that if a person has TB, which is highly contagious even through coughing, we all recognize that it's more important that that person be quarantined, kept to himself, and not be permitted to walk through society, than for let hundreds of people get infected by that one person. That's one of the controversies over the HIV and the AIDS. But the minds of people understand if one person has TB and dies, that is better than if that person has the liberty to walk throughout society and infect hundreds of thousands and start an epidemic that would infect millions, perhaps. Nobody could accept that as justifiable. Why? That's an understanding of public justice and public good. That's an understanding that if necessary, one person would need to deny himself his liberties and be called upon to for the sake of the public good. That's a recognition of that. And our laws reflect that, except for this one case. And if it could be demonstrated, I believe, that AIDS could be passed through coughing or such as that, I believe that we would see quarantine of AIDS patients. But people recognize that principle. If one person can destroy the lives of thousands, that one person's got to go, either voluntarily and times involuntarily. And when is the involuntary time? When is the time that he goes involuntarily?
Incarceration.
The law comes in and starts exercising itself through the judicial system. It arrests the person. It charges the person with a crime. And because this person is destroying the public good, he must stop. If he won't stop voluntarily, he must be stopped by the law. You're raising children, and you won't tell them no, there's going to come a day when the end of a gun held by a man in a blue suit is going to tell him no. And that's his job. And rightly so. And we all value that. Because he is doing to a person what their parents failed to do and what that person has failed to do themselves, is to keep themselves in conformity to promoting the public good and not just his own. So, we have the execution or the administration of law, where we get into accusation of a crime, right? Charge with a crime. Where are we now? If somebody's charged with a crime, where are we? We're in a courtroom, right? What do we have in a courtroom? Sitting up there. Judge. Mr. Wapner. Judge Wapner, right? We have a judge in a courtroom. O.J. Simpson's hearing so far in his trial is going to be a marvelous education for people on American law and on law itself. Because it will demonstrate what I'm going to show. You get accused of a crime by the people, by the state. It's their job. Not by an individual comes in. The state versus so-and-so. Gets accused of a crime. How do you plead Next is the plea. There's only two ways to plea, is it not? Or is there? Three ways. Okay, what are the three ways?
Guilty, not guilty, and no contest.
Oh, okay. Okay. Any other ways?
Yes.
Okay. Justifiable. Guilty, but justified. Or, huh?
He's not a moral agent,
therefore he'd be excused, wouldn't he? From what we've learned, right? If he lost his moral agency somewhere along the way, he would not be held. Now, when I said guilty, but it wasn't a reason, I meant I did the act. But because I have a good and sufficient reason, and it's true, I am justified in doing the act that you consider a crime, but I'm going to demonstrate to you why I did it, and you're going to see the reason is sufficient and good and true, and you'll let me off. So the person makes a plea. Not guilty is the plea, whereby he may say, I didn't do it at all, or I did an act that you accuse me of, but the motive for it, I will demonstrate to you, is a true and sufficient reason to not convict me of a crime. Then what happens? Trial. Evidence is presented, right? Evidence is presented to the jury or to the judge. Evidence is laid out to demonstrate that this person did the act, did it with a motive, violated the law, they're guilty. Then the judge or the jury passes a verdict, guilty or not guilty. Then what? Sentencing for the penalty. When you've gotten done with all that process and you've sentenced him to the penalty, then what? What's the next stage?
Execution
of the penalty. By whom? State, representatives, law enforcement.
Moral government.
I'm thinking more of which branch of government?
Executive
branch. Not the judge anymore. The judge has nothing more to do with the case. The judge looks over the accusations, all the process we talked about, but once that penalty has been decided, the executive branch executes the penalty. Now it gets thrown on the governor. That's why governors can give what?
Pardon.
Doesn't come from the judge. Comes from the governor. Now, isn't that interesting? Okay? Can the judge give a pardon?
No.
Judge cannot give a pardon. He is not empowered by the government or law to give a pardon. He cannot do it. What is the only hope for a person who's been convicted and found guilty and sentenced to keep from finding that sentence falling upon him? What is his only hope under the law?
Retrial.
Under the law. Two hopes? Okay. Retrial.
Retrial.
Okay.
And the hope of the pardon by the executive.
Okay. That's a working of government. That's not a working of law. And the distinction I'm making. The distinction I'm making, and I can see where you might include the two. He has two hopes, but under law he's only got one hope, and that's to go back into the courtroom with a new trial and prove the state was wrong. Prove the evidence was tampered with, prove somebody lied, prove the judge did not rule properly on motions and things like that. To get off, that person has to go back and prove the state was wrong. Not the person. Right? If a person is convicted of a crime, they've got to go back and impeach the state and demonstrate that the state did not uphold law correctly, that the state is at fault for this penalty that he's sitting under. That's the concept. That's the bottom line if a person goes back into court after being convicted and sentenced, right? Even after being convicted. Now it falls upon the state to defend itself and prove that its first handling of the law was proper, according to law. And there was no partiality involved, there was no personal thing going on. It was all according to law. You see that? The state now becomes the defender. If a person goes back to court, new evidence, whatever. Stay, you missed it. Even if there's new evidence, state missed it. Because the evidence that they convicted him on was insufficient if there's new evidence to support that he's innocent. And what is he going after? Innocence. Proving back in court that he's innocent, right? His first plea is not guilty, even though he may be guilty. People plead not guilty. But the only way to get off under law is to be proven not guilty, or to avoid being proven guilty. It's presumed that he's innocent. He's trying to avoid being proven guilty. So his defense is not guilty. Now, if he did the act, what would be some good and sufficient and true reasons why he should not be held guilty?
Self-defense
would be justifiable. Speaking of murder or something, or killing a person, that would be justifiable. Okay, that would be a good, sufficient, and true reason that the courts would recognize. If he lost his moral agency, where his mind was not functioning, as however the law would define it, if he came under that definition, they would not pronounce him guilty. They might put him in a hospital to change his state or whatever, but they would not hold him guilty because he acted when he did not have his moral agency intact, according to the view and the definition of law. What else? What else would be a sufficient?
Accidental.
Okay. Did not intend to do this. There's a man in Palm Springs, California, a day worker. He was cutting trees for somebody. Okay. He cut this tree down, it fell into an aluminum patio cover, fell through the cover, killed a four-year-old girl. He's been arrested for, not murder, but manslaughter. Because the thinking is, although he did not intend to kill the girl, his actions were sufficiently careless that he is still responsible to some degree to the consequences of his actions. Okay. The law defines these things.
No self-defense law.
Okay. 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 So this person has been convicted with the penalty hanging over his head. His only hope under law is to go back to court and prove the court was wrong. His only hope under government is pardon from the governor. Right? What's the difference between the two? If he were to go back into court and get proven not guilty or be sentenced or declared not guilty, or if he gets a pardon, what's the difference as far as his guilt goes? Is there any difference? John?
One he's pardoned with guilt, the other one he can't be let off unless they can prove he really wasn't guilty. Now, it's through the law, they have to prove his innocence. But through the pardon, the executive branch, even though he is guilty, he can be pardoned.
Okay.
Pardon
implies guilt. Under the law, you have to prove he's guilty. He has to go back and prove that that the law was wrong, and therefore they would have to establish that he was innocent after all. But if he did win under the law back in the court, the final verdict would be not guilty. But when you receive a pardon, you are confessing guilty. Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon. Remember that? And people threw their arms up in the air, put on sackcloth and ashes, and threw dust on their face. Wait a minute. You pardon this guy who we know is guilty of these high crimes in government. The highest authority in the land has been corrupted. That was a governmental crisis because it could have brought down, in fact, our government. It had the potential to that. Gerald Ford later said, the people who said, you let him off. You let him off. Gerald Ford said, the offer of pardon is to impute guilt. The acceptance of a pardon is to confess it. But pardon is conceived of as a declaration of not guilty by too many people. It is not a declaration of not guilty. A pardon is a declaration of guilty, but you're not going to receive the punishment. What's another word for pardon? Excuse me? Okay. Another word for pardon is to forgive. Everybody know that? Forgiveness is not a declaration of not guilty. Not that. Pardon and forgiveness are the same thing, and they mean you are guilty. But you do not have to suffer the penalty. The penalty will be withheld. Penalty withheld. Though you deserve it, the penalty will be withheld. It is not a declaration of not guilty. When God forgives, He is not declaring this person is not guilty. When God forgives, it is a declaration. When the person receives pardon, they are declaring the same thing that God already knew, that they are guilty. But that God is going to withhold the penalty.
I think you have to understand something here with pardon and forgiveness. They're not necessarily synonymous. Because a pardon is
it's the same.
It's not forgiveness of the act done. There's no forgiveness of any act done without repentance.
Well, those are conditions of pardon. But pardon. That may be, but they violated the law. That then may be, but they have reasons to give pardons, and they follow the law as reasons. Under God's government, which I said extends further than human government, God requires repentance, faith, forsaking of sin, and obedience. All of those flow out of faith. Under God's government, it is revealed that the conditions of God's pardon and forgiveness are faith, repentance, confession, and obedience, without which He will not pardon. Pardon and forgiveness are the same. That wonderful parable where he called in the servant to account for his accounts, and he says, I owe you $20 million. Sent him off with a penalty. He says, I can't pay. Please let me work to pay it off. And he had compassion on him. He says, I forgive you. Did he say, you don't owe me? No. He said, you owe me, but I have decided you don't have to pay me because I had compassion on you. Compassion is a word that is synonymous with mercy, or translated in conjunction with mercy. In the New Old Testament, thy compassions fail not, thy loving kindness, are all words associated with mercy. He had compassion on him. Then he went out, and another person owed him $20. He says, please let me pay, give me time to pay it, I'll work and pay you back. He wouldn't have compassion on him. He says, no, you're going to receive the penalty. He was forgiven, pardoned, which means that owner did not say, you don't owe me anymore. Somebody else paid me, you don't owe me. He said, no, you owe me, but I do not require it of you. I suffer the loss, not you. You should suffer it. I suffer it. I bear the loss. I will not require you to bear the loss. What is mercy? Mercy is an attribute of love. It's one of the qualities of love. Mercy is the disposition to set aside the penalty of the law. Willingness directly sets aside, mercy directly sets aside justice. Directly sets aside justice, prevents justice from proceeding. Justice requires the execution of the penalty. Pardon sets aside the execution of the penalty. You've got two conflicting things going on. Between mercy and justice, though both mercy and justice are attributes of love. Mercy is the willingness, when can safely be done, to give pardon to the criminal, to forgive the criminal, withhold the execution of the penalty, when public justice will not suffer. Remember that. If public justice would suffer in pardoning the sinner, God cannot remain a good moral governor and yet pardon the sinner. He does not uphold his law. He does not uphold his government. He does not give his subjects continued reasons to trust him. That he is, in fact, seeking the public good and only the public good. And if he gave one sinner pardon that he could not safely do so, then why doesn't he do it all? That would be partiality, wouldn't it? If he pardoned and forgave one person when it was not conducive to the public good, then in impartiality he should do it for all, and they would have a right to demand it, to receive that same kind of treatment. So the pardon given under God's moral government must be impartial, under the same conditions for all, and it must not threaten public justice, the public good, and the rule of law. That's a puzzle. That's a dilemma. Because you've got mercy wanting to stop the execution of the penalty, justice demanding that it do. You've got both of those attributes in God at the same time. The willingness to do both. How in the world is that reconciled? How does the mercy of God proceed and forgive the sinner and withhold the execution of the penalty that he deserves without endangering the public good and public justice and public law?
Romans 3:23-26.
The cross. God is the justifier, and he still remains just because of the blood of Christ, because of the atonement that's been set forth by God. The death of Christ, the sufferings of Christ, the atonement, however wordage that you would use, the work of Christ, is God's provision as a governmental expedient so that mercy can be given without bringing down his government. It is a sufficient reason in the eyes of his government and those who behold him to continue to trust him that he is, in fact, still benevolent, even if he does not execute the penalty of the law. The death of sufferings and death of Christ is a governmental necessity for God's government to be merciful and remain just, that is, to remain righteous in its administration of law. The death and suffering and death of Christ secures the same end for public justice that the execution of the law would secure on the sinner. If it was executed upon the sinner, it would achieve a certain end. The sufferings and death of Christ achieve the same end in governmental reasons and purposes as the penalty would. What is grace? We haven't even come to grace yet. That's just mercy. Most people confuse these two and think that we've been talking about grace so far. But this is strictly mercy, and it has that one particular function to withhold the execution of the penalty. But what is grace? Okay, unmerited favor, giving what don't deserve. Mercy is not giving what one deserves. Grace is giving what one doesn't deserve. One deserves penalty and its execution. Mercy withholds it. The sinner does not deserve his favor, and God gives it. And that attribute of God giving his favor to those who don't deserve it is called grace. They don't merit his favor, but he gives it anyway. Upon what justification can he favor the sinner who deserves punishment? The sufferings and death of Christ make it justifiable for God to give the sinner favor when he doesn't deserve it. This and its blessings and benefits can be received, whether you fully understand all of its details or not, by believing that it is God's appointed means of securing mercy and grace to the sinner